Today's Journey to Wellness in Indian Country is made possible by the University of Minnesota Medical School, Duluth Campus, educating medical students dedicated to serving rural Minnesota and American Indian Alaska Native communities.
Journey to Wellness on Northland Morning is made possible in part with funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Recently, there were a variety of really informative presentations held online to talk about the issue of sex trafficking in our area. And one of those panels had to do with missing and murdered Indigenous women. Rebecca St. George is our city attorney, and she has been since last year. But she worked 10 years at Mending the Sacred Hoop before that. Then she went to law school. Then she worked for the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And she's got some really fascinating insights through these different jobs that you've held and perspectives that you've had to adopt. Back when you were at Mending the Sacred Hoop, the emphasis was on violence and against Native women and how this was not a traditional value. And you talked about how you and the people that you were working with struggled to figure out where it came from, in a sense. What were some of the things you discovered?
Sure. Thanks, Lisa. And thanks for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here. So I wouldn't say we exactly discovered it. It was a lot of research and listening to our elders and listening to people who still hold a lot of that history and tradition. What we learned, and this is something we learned that was pretty consistent across Indian country. So definitely locally here in sort of Ojibwe land, but also across the country, I think, is that in most traditional communities, if you go back pre-colonization for sure, violence against women on this continent was very, very rare. It's not like it didn't exist. It's not like it wasn't there, but it was rare. And when it happened, it was handled in very, very different ways than what you saw happening at the same time over in Europe, right? So for instance, early rape laws in Europe were property crimes, right? If you rape a woman, it's not a crime against her, it's a crime against whatever man is responsible for her, whatever man owns her. So it was a property crime against her father or her husband. At the same time here, any crime like that against a woman on this continent was generally handled as a victim-centered response. How is the victim, what does she want to have happen? The whole community would come out, right? You know, and if you look at domestic violence, for instance, it happened, but it was rare. And part of what kept it so rare here was that marriage wasn't a matter of ownership, right? Like early marriage over in Europe was more about, women didn't have any rights. And that was true here, early colonization, up until like the 70s, right? You couldn't have your own credit card. It belonged to your husband. Traditional Native communities, women, they were their own person, and divorce wasn't a big deal. Getting married was a big deal. Might be difficult to get married and go through a lot of, you know, ceremony or whatever. But if you were done, if he did something to hurt you, you left and the community supported you. And they didn't support his violence. And also part of that, children weren't seen as property, right? So a really common tactic for abusers is to use the children and to hold the children over the victim. Well, that just wasn't possible because the entire community was responsible for the children. They weren't the property of anyone. They were members of the community. And so what we find, when you're addressing things like domestic violence and rape, one thing that can be really helpful is to look at the point of origin. Where did it come from and what does that look like? In Indian communities, in some ways that's almost easy. We can look at boarding schools. You talk to almost any Indian family and say, you know, how violent was your family? Even if you have violence in your family today, how violent was it before your grandma went to boarding school, before grandpa went to boarding school? And it wasn't there. There's that point of origin where we were disconnected from our families, where we were disconnected from our traditions. And so that gives us a great tool for addressing it. Right? So these are not our traditional ways. These are not our traditional values. We have traditional values that don't allow for that kind of behavior. And so we can fix it.
One of the things that you said in the panel the other night that sexual violence is so common that it took a real effort to actually see it. It was so pervasive. You said, I don't know a Native woman who hasn't been sexually assaulted, that you had to get to a point where you took a second look at this thing that was a part of your life and a part of the life of everybody else around you. And the community had to say, oh, this is not the way we want to be. What was that realization like for you as you were growing and progressing in your career and your insight and your understanding and your work as an advocate?
I mean, I wouldn't say I all of a sudden woke up. It was a progression. One thing I want to say, so I don't forget, is the work that's been done nationally around sexual violence against Native women. One of the realities that's come out that's stark and hard is that the majority of rapes against Native women are not perpetrated by Native men. They're more likely to, we're the only sort of race that the violence tends to be cross-racial, right? Like typically white women are more often raped by white men than men of other races. Black women are more often raped by black men than men of other races. Native women are more often raped by non-Native men, whether that's white men or black men or someone else, which isn't to say that Native men never rape, and it's not to say that all white men rape or anything like that, but it's just sort of this unusual anomaly that I think goes back to colonization and how rape has been used against Native women and continues to be. So there's this realization, I think any person who's suffered from sexual assault, one of the things it does to you is it makes you feel very, very, very isolated, right? It's a very lonely thing. And it's really easy to blame yourself. And it's really easy to feel like, you know, it's your fault. And so sometimes then you don't tell people about it, because why would you? Because you're so ashamed. It brings so much shame. And so it became a thing where we were talking more and it was coming out more. And that realization that, yeah, it's not just me, right? It's my relatives and it's my friends and it's my cousins and it's this whole community. And it makes you angry, right? Like, it makes you really angry and it's really upsetting. But it also gives you a place to start healing and to start trying to do something about it. And watching this amazing movement that's been happening for the last, 10, 15 years has been so wonderful. There are so many strong, amazing Native women coming out and doing something about it.
You talked about how the emphasis on missing and murdered Indigenous women and people is important. But you said basically by the time someone goes missing or is killed, that's the culmination of perhaps years of steps along the way, incremental changes, escalation in the way that they're being treated, and that it's so important to be vigilant. You said even if our sisters and aunties aren't being murdered or they're not going missing, they're still being hurt. And you also talked about when you went to Fond du Lac, you started to see how some of these other issues that were a problem in the community, you weren't working as a direct advocate anymore, but as you started handling different kinds of issues at Fond du Lac that were a problem in the community, you started seeing how all of these things kept circling back to this idea of domestic and sexual violence.
And trafficking.
I noticed with interest that you admitted you were a little worried about, I'm not a direct advocate anymore, and I'm not sure I'm going to like this if I can't be a direct advocate, but you discovered that you could be, and you were.
Well, I mean, I wasn't, and I'm not. And I think that's the thing, is that in a way, if I'm using the right language, everyone needs to be, right? So it's not my job, and it probably never will be again. I don't know that I'll ever work for sort of a nonprofit organization where I'm doing advocacy like that. But I think every person who has a job where you intersect with the public in any way, whether it's behind the scenes or in the front, has an opportunity to see, has an opportunity to recognize the gendered violence that happens everywhere in our communities, whether you're working for public works or you're a hairdresser, right? You know, cops, obviously, police officers have opportunities. Prosecutors have opportunities to see, like, how do we handle some of these crimes? But before they're recognized as crimes, everyone, teachers, everyone, if we have the right education, if we have the right eyes, we can see where people are being hurt and find ways to do something about it. We can see where people, and sometimes people we love, are hurting other people, right? Because that's the other part of it. We can deal with victims till we're blue in the face. Until people stop hurting people, it's not going to go away. And so being able to recognize that sometimes people that we respect and sometimes people we love are actually the perpetrators of some of this violence. Sometimes our coworkers are. And so it's the realization that no matter what you're doing and no matter where you're working, you have an opportunity to pay attention and to bring things to light.
You talked about one of the early issues that you dealt with when the chief of police came to you asking for help, because apparently there were semi-trucks cutting through the reservation to avoid the weigh stations. Talk about that incident, because that was really an interesting example that you cited.
Right. It was an interesting conversation because he, you know, it was very much about this sort of discreet thing, right? Here's these trucks coming through. How do we handle them? I don't know why they're necessarily wanting to skip the weigh stations. Maybe they have too much weight, but you know, what's the deal? And my first thought, because I was fairly fresh out of doing just advocacy all the time, was, well, obviously they're trafficking people, right? Like, this is why they want to avoid the weigh stations and the cops, is because they're doing something. You know, his first thought when I sort of started, I didn't say that right away. I said, well, you know, what do you think they're avoiding? And he had this like, yeah, they're probably trafficking drugs, which is also probably true, right? But as we started to talk more about the potential that they're using, you know, our community to traffic people through, it led him to start working, and maybe he already was doing more. I don't want to take credit for the work that Fond du Lac police were doing, because they've done some really amazing things. But they started bringing in more training, and they started doing more work, and they started being a lot more overt about how they were able to see when, you know, when a traffic stop, a simple traffic stop, sometimes it's an opportunity. There's somebody in the car that's being trafficked, right? Like, they started to be able to do some of those things, and it led to them organizing this tribal trafficking task force, which is the first in the nation, intertribal work that they're doing. And it's incredible. And I think they've been pretty effective.
In your position now with the city of Duluth, you mentioned that you're not prosecuting traffickers, but you are prosecuting domestic violence. And you emphasized the importance of not criminalizing victimhood. And you also said that sometimes that line is really razor thin if a woman is fighting back and if she hurts or kills somebody. You know, is she a victim or is she a perpetrator, and what needs to happen? Talk about what you're hoping to do and what you're holding in your mind as you step into your still comparatively new role with the city.
I feel like I'm still really new. Want to be clear, the reason we don't prosecute traffickers is because that falls under the jurisdiction of the county. It's not because we wouldn't do it. Just want to be clear on that. Part of my goal in my office and with the prosecutors that I'm working with in my office is to be very, very astute and good at being able to do that analysis. You know, when a domestic violence case comes into our office, I want us to be able to just be sharp as can be. Are we prosecuting the right person? There's an awful lot of mutual violence that happens with domestic violence. That doesn't mean that there's mutual power, right? That doesn't mean that both people are, you know, quote unquote, perpetrators or batterers. And so it takes a really keen eye to be able to see that difference. Sometimes it's obvious, right? Sometimes it's just really obvious. And the Duluth police are known internationally for the work that they do with domestic violence. And we get a lot of new police, and sometimes they make mistakes. And so I want our prosecutors for the city to be the best that can be in being able to recognize things like that, in being able to recognize sort of a victim-centered approach to how we prosecute domestic violence in a way that doesn't hurt the victims, make it worse for them, because sometimes it does make it worse for them. You know, whatever we do, we have a weird amount of power to impact these victims' lives and these perpetrators' lives. And I want our team, and we've got an amazing team, and I think they do a great job. So I don't want to say like, oh, we've got this long road to go, but just I want us to be the best possible.
When Sheila Lamb spoke at the same panel that evening, she talked about a case in Duluth that it involved trafficking. And she said by the time it was ready to be resolved, she said, after all of the work that the police and the prosecutors had done to build this trafficking case, it came down to a plea bargain, and the people who were culpable ended up not being charged with trafficking, not being charged with whatever felonies are involved in that. And she said, no, we have got to not let people plea bargain their way out of these things. The police and people need to be able to keep track of these crimes, and we need to hold these systems accountable. How do you make those kinds of changes? And wouldn't the defense attorney say, no, I'm not going for that because I'm charged to do the very best for my client that I can?
So plea bargaining is a really, I don't want to say complicated, but it's, you know, our courts are imperfect. And by imperfect, I mean our criminal justice system is fairly broken, I would say. There's a lot of massive change that needs to happen for it to actually be fair and effective. And that's a whole nother conversation, right? Plea bargains are sometimes the right way to go. Sometimes a prosecutor is looking at a case and they don't have enough of the right evidence to get, even if they know this is a felony, this is a trafficker, I know that this person is doing all of these things and I want to get some sort of justice for them. If they don't have the right evidence to get that, sometimes the best they can do is say, you know, how about you plead guilty to this thing instead of the bigger thing? I think drug traffickers getting tax evasion because you couldn't get a, because, and with something like trafficking, it is such a difficult thing to investigate. Because A, there's so much brainwashing. B, never mind the brainwashing, it is not safe for victims of that crime to cooperate with the police or the system. It's just not safe, right? And so the ability to get the right evidence is extremely difficult. And it's not safe because we don't have good systems in place to keep them safe, right? So, and part of that, and then it sort of circles around itself. So, you know, I'm not going to really cooperate with you, so you're not going to get great evidence, so you're going to plea bargain, so they're going to come out and keep abusing me. Also, you're not going to keep them in jail forever, no matter what, almost, unless there's been a murder. And so they're going to come out and get me, and they have other people who might come out and get me. So there's a safety issue that makes investigation sort of inherently difficult.
Are you able to envision changes coming down the road, you know, or if we could change this, then we'd be able to keep these people safe and it would be easier for them to testify? Is that really where the fix for trafficking belongs? Or does the fix for trafficking start a lot closer to home in terms of keeping our kids or helping our kids become strong and whole and less vulnerable?
I think the fix, the hard fix for trafficking and sexual violence is, and I'm going to use gendered language because the vast majority of perpetrators are men, not all. I know there's always the, oh, there was this woman or there's a few women, and there are definitely men who are victims, especially when you're coming to sexual violence. So, you know, that's my caveat with the gendered violence. But I think until we can convince our boys and men that they don't have a right to our bodies, I don't know that we're going to be able to do a ton other than try to keep people safe, right? Like, as long as we're saying, you know, you're not going to, it's this victim blaming thing, right? That is really difficult because we're coming from this place of how can I help protect women? How can I help protect girls? Well, as long as there are men who think it's okay to take advantage of us, to use us, to sell us, to buy and sell us, it's just going to keep happening. I don't care how strong and smart you are. And that's one of the things when you work with victims of sexual violence or domestic violence, actually any violence, almost any one of them will say, before this happened to me, I was so strong. I was so confident. And sometimes after it happened, I am. Sometimes I still am, right? Or it gets to a place. But almost every time you'll find people who are like, oh yeah, no, that was never going to happen to me, right? Like I was strong. I was invulnerable. I had all those things. And we do those things. But as long as you have a power structure that allows men to continue to do this, that's the fix, is to convince men that they don't want to anymore. Whether it's because they're going to go to prison or because they've figured out that it hurts them as much as it's hurting, right? Like this is a harm to society.
Rebecca St. George is the Duluth City attorney, and she joined us this morning on Journey to Wellness in Indian Country. Journey to Wellness here on KUMD is supported in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
And is also made possible by the University of Minnesota Medical School, Duluth Campus, a national leader in improving healthcare access and outcomes in rural Minnesota and American Indian, Alaska Native communities.